Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 2nd of July, these are our main stories. Partial results from Russia suggest President Putin has won a resounding victory in a referendum, cementing his hold on power for another 16 years. Nearly 400 people have been arrested in Hong Kong following protests against a new security law imposed by China, and coronavirus restrictions are being tightened in California after a resurgence of cases there. Also in this podcast,
it's about 3.5 times the radius of Earth, but around 40 times the mass.
The newly discovered rock in space, which is exciting astronomers. We begin in Russia. Sounds of protesters in the Russian city of St. Petersburg on Wednesday, where polls have closed following a referendum on a package of measures which could see President Putin remain in power for another 16 years. As we record this podcast, with more than 60% of ballots counted, the indication is that a big majority of voters backed the proposals. But opposition activists such as Andrei Pivovarov from the Open Russia movement have denounced the poll.
What happened was not legitimate, not a procedure, not a referendum. A rigged mock procedure was offered to us. No legal decision can be based on it. I believe we cannot recognise this vote.
Our correspondent Sarah Rainsford in Moscow has been following developments.
With a big chunk of the votes already counted, actually, it looks like a resounding success for the Kremlin. Well over 75% of people voting in favour of this reform, which is perhaps at the high end of expectations, even for the Kremlin. But always, I think, you know, they were expecting to win fairly impressively, and it seems that that has happened. I think another thing that's interesting to note in this is that the turnout is recorded at around about 65%, which again, I think the Kremlin will be pleased that they wanted as many people to participate in this process as possible to lend it more legitimacy.
There has been criticism of the way the vote was handled. The opposition figure Alexei Navalny, for instance, described it as a huge lie. Does any of that matter?
Well, it does matter if you're trying to portray yourself as a Democrat. I don't think Vladimir Putin likes to see himself as anything else. And I think, you know, that's part of the reason why he wanted this vote to happen in the first place. I mean, bear in mind that this constitution, this new constitution, has actually already been passed by Parliament. And really, according to Russian law, there didn't need to be a vote at all. This was President Putin's own initiative, because I think he wanted to show himself, to show the country, to show everybody that he had big support for these changes, big changes, of course. And of course, this idea of him staying on as president. So in that democratic process, he wants the vote to look legitimate too. So I think all the sort of mocking by the opposition does hurt to some extent. There is an awful lot of cynicism here in many parts in Russia, a lack of trust for their politicians, a lack of trust for the entire democratic process. And I think that can only be harmful.
So what happens next? He has been apparently gifted this big win in terms of the referendum. As you say, Parliament has already passed this. It doesn't necessarily mean he's going to be in the Kremlin for the next 16 years, does it?
Not necessarily, no. He's going to be there for the next 4 years, according to this term he's already serving, and then he can decide, effectively. I think what this does is takes the question off the table. It's always been a big question ever since he was last elected president, you know, who would come next? Because according to the Constitution, 2024 was when he should step down. And there was questioning already, you know, people, rumours flying, people speculating about what would happen next, what would he do? And this removes that instability, if you like, as he presents it. But certainly it removes the uncertainty about what happens next in Russia. So much is invested in Vladimir Putin. So much in Russian politics surrounds him, extends from him, that it is absolutely critical to the political future of the country. So that's now off the table. President Putin has said himself he hasn't decided what he'll do in 2024, but he's sort of slightly coyly hinted at the fact that he plans to be around for some time.
That was Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. President Trump has insisted that he was never told by the US Secret Services about reports that Russia paid Afghanistan's Taliban militants to kill American soldiers. Moscow and the Taliban have denied the allegations. From Washington, Gary O'Donoghue reports.
For several days, the administration has been saying that reports of bounties being paid by Russia did not reach the president's desk and that there was no consensus within the intelligence community about the veracity of the claims. However, at the same time, the White House has also been briefing senior members of both parties in Congress, with some Republicans clearly taking the allegations seriously. The US military has been warned about the claims and contingencies have been put in place, according to the National Security Advisor. Yet the president has equivocated over the existence of the intelligence, accusing the fake news of peddling a hoax.
That was Gary O'Donoghue. Coronavirus restrictions are tightening up in California because of an increase in infections. California's governor, Gavin Newsom, told 19 counties that entertainment venues, including restaurants, cinemas, zoos and museums, must stop all indoor activities as the state experiences increasing numbers of COVID-19 infections. Bars must close completely.
Bottom line is the spread of this virus continues at a rate that is particularly concerning. We're seeing parts of the state where we are seeing an increase in not only the total number of positive cases, but a significant increase in the total number of people that are getting tested that are testing positive is beginning to go up to a degree that obviously generates some concern.
Hospitalizations related to the virus have risen by over 40%. I asked David Willis, our correspondent in Los Angeles, just how serious this spike is in infections.
Very serious, Jackie, and having been a coronavirus success story for most of the spring, California has seen an explosion in new cases of the virus, which has grown by nearly 50% over the course of the past 2 weeks. And there are now more than 230,000 confirmed coronavirus cases here. Of greater concern to officials, though, is the steady growth in hospitalizations. Those have risen 43% in the past fortnight, as a result of which Governor Newsom has announced a tightening of restrictions across around 70% of the state. Bars, cinemas, other facilities will be closing for at least 3 weeks. Restaurants, too, for indoor dining, partly because, of course, we're approaching the 4th of July weekend, where people are expected to gather in large groups to celebrate Independence Day.
So Governor Newsom describes these as effective and careful measures. Do the experts agree that it's enough? And what happens if these measures don't work?
Gavin Newsom believes that California can get the virus under control again, but public health officials say that the state could have squandered the work that it did to control the pandemic in the early days back in March and April by devolving basically too much control over reopening to individual counties, and some of those counties chose to reopen once case counts started to stabilize and may well have acted precipitantly, as a result of which California is now paying the price, if you like.
David Willis in California. Hong Kong police have arrested nearly 400 people following violent clashes with protesters opposed to a new security law imposed by China. 10 of the arrests were under the new legislation, which allows for punishments of up to life in prison. A number of police were injured in the clashes. One was stabbed in the arm. Pepper spray and water cannon were used to clear demonstrators from the streets. The protest on the 23rd anniversary of the end of British rule had been banned. This report is by our Beijing correspondent John Sudworth.
...23 years after China took control of Hong Kong, it was an anniversary marked with tear gas and arrests. All too familiar scenes, but with the stakes for the city's pro-democracy protesters now so much higher, with the new national security law in force. For Hong Kong's pro-Beijing leaders, though, this was a day to celebrate, with a flag-raising ceremony and a champagne toast with Chinese military officers. And in Beijing, Jiang Xiaoming, a senior official with China's State Council, dismissed the mounting international condemnation.
What we are doing now is enacting a law to maintain national security in an administrative region of the People's Republic of China. This is not the business of other countries, but entirely our own internal matter.
Hong Kong's protesters, though, are certain that something fundamental is being lost.
I think very obviously the purpose of law is to change Hong Kong from rule of law to rule of fear.
I am protesting because I am very angry. I am angry at the breach of the basic law. I'm angry at the breach of one country, two systems. And I'm angry at the disrespect for human rights.
Even peaceful protest is now a target. Hong Kong's police were seen holding up new banners warning the crowds that chanting slogans and carrying placards calling for Hong Kong's independence could constitute secession or subversion, new offences punishable with up to life in prison.
That was John Sudworth in Beijing. As many as 3 million people in Hong Kong are being granted new rights to live and work in Britain after China pressed ahead with the imposition of that new security law. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced the legislation as a clear and serious breach of the treaty that China signed with the UK when it took back control of the former colony in 1997. The UK government is drawing up a set of arrangements that would allow residents with British passports, as well as their dependents, to settle here in the UK and ultimately apply for citizenship. China reacted angrily to the move when it was initially suggested in May. The details from our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale.
When China first threatened to impose national security laws on Hong Kong, the government said it would respond by making it easier for some British nationals there to come and live in the UK. Today, after the new laws were enacted and the first arrests made, the government said it would fulfil that promise and extended the offer too. The Prime Minister told MPs the new laws were a clear and serious breach of the joint declaration that Britain and China had signed, guaranteeing Hong Kong's autonomy.
We made clear, Mr. Speaker, that if China continued down this path, we would reintroduce a new route for those with British national overseas status to enter the UK, granting them limited leave to remain, with the ability to live and work in the UK and thereafter to apply for citizenship, and that is precisely what we will do now.
Initially, that offer was for 350,000 people born before 1997 with British national overseas passports to spend renewable periods of 12 months here without needing a visa. The Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, said the offer would now automatically apply to everyone with so-called BNO status. That's almost 3 million people. And they would have the right to work or study in the UK for 5 years, after which they could apply for settled status and then citizenship. There would be no quotas, and crucially, family dependents would be eligible, potentially providing a route to the UK for younger pro-democracy campaigners. There's no estimate of how many people may come, but officials expect many may stay in Hong Kong or go elsewhere. Across the world, there was growing condemnation of the new security law, in particular Article 38, which potentially could see foreigners prosecuted for offences overseas. The US Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said this was an affront to all nations. The former governor of Hong Kong, Lord Paton, said this was worse than expected.
And this is Orwellian stuff, but it does go wider and further than anybody had feared. It appears to cover people who aren't Chinese citizens, who aren't Hong Kong citizens. It appears to have an extraterritorial aspect as well. So heaven knows how it'll affect the ability of journalists to report what's happening in Hong Kong.
In the Commons, there was cross-party support for the government's response. But much will depend now on how China responds and whether there may be an economic price to pay just when Britain needs all the trade and investment it can find.
That was James Landale. More than 110 people in the Indian state of Bihar have tested positive for coronavirus after they were guests at a wedding. The groom has died. Everyone who attended has now been identified and isolated. An investigation's underway to see if the strict social distancing regulations that were in place at the time were breached. Our reporter in Delhi, Davina Gupta, has been following the story.
The groom came from Delhi and he drove down in a car with the rest of his family in the last week of May. And according to the family, he was in quarantine for about 14 days, after which the rituals for a Hindu ceremony started, which go on for at least 2 days. And during that, the groom showed some symptoms of diarrhea, which is related to COVID-19 as well. And he was hospitalized, where the family members got him discharged so that they could go through the rest of the wedding rituals. So on June 15th, he got married, and despite showing some indications that he's unwell, and 2 days after that, sadly, he passed away. Now, the family members initially cremated his body. There was no testing done, so one doesn't know whether he was a COVID positive case at that time. But after that, in just a matter of 2 to 3 days, they started seeing symptoms of the guests who had participated in the wedding. Now, in India, there's a rule at the moment because of the coronavirus crisis that if you're organizing a wedding, you can't have more than 50 guests. But it seems that the family had violated this norm and this rule, because around 111 people so far have tested positive. That area has now been marked as a containment zone. The district authorities are now carrying out investigation on where the lapses were and why was a wedding more than 50 people allowed to take place, and what were the norms that were flouted for social distancing during the rituals.
Indian weddings are famous around the world for the huge numbers and how lavish they are and how beautiful they are. It must be very difficult to try and persuade people in India that they can't do that.
Absolutely. I think you're right on that, because apart from this particular wedding, which the Indian wedding, especially the Hindu weddings, the rituals actually go on for days. There are concerns around the groom and the bride getting married as per the astrological time. So it has to be an auspicious time in which they have to be married. Having said that, it's also a wedding season in India. So in different cities, people are trying to see if they can do these nuptials online. But not everybody is using this kind of method of technology. So even though the government is trying to regulate that and asking them to register that only 50 people should come to a wedding venue, most people are not following the norms. And that's where the real risk is.
Davina Gupta in Delhi. Still to come.
The name that really jumps out at you is Ali Haddad. He expanded and expanded his business interests until he was running an empire involved in construction, the media.
A court in Algeria has given heavy prison sentences to a number of people who are close to the ousted president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika. To Vietnam now, home to 95 million people. It has managed to keep a remarkable record in its fight against COVID-19, at least according to its official statistics. Only a few hundred cases have been confirmed. There have been just a handful of intensive care unit admissions and not a single recorded death. The lack of strain on the health service appears to have proved particularly fortuitous for a British pilot in Hanoi, as the BBC's Oliver Barnes has been finding out.
It took just over 2 weeks from when Stephen Cameron was woken up from a medically induced coma for him to utter his first words.
Just today, the first day, you can talk, you can speak. How do you feel?
Fantastic.
The 42-year-old Scottish pilot spent 68 days on a ventilator, a longer stretch of time than any patient we're aware of back home in the UK. He did so not in a hospital in his hometown of Motherwell, but in Vietnam's sprawling and hectic Ho Chi Minh City.
The decision was made to put me under, and they said, do you consent? I said yes, because I just thought, no, I'll go to sleep, I'll wake up, it'll all be fixed.
When Stephen was first ventilated in early April, there were just over 1 million cases of coronavirus around the world. When doctors woke him up on the 12th of June, there were in excess of 7 million. But Vietnam had avoided the worst of the virus. There's not been a case of community transmission in the country for over 70 days, and it's halted its tally of confirmed cases at under 350. It's the low level of strain on Vietnam's health system which Stephen credits with keeping him alive.
My friend Craig was told by the Foreign Commonwealth Office I had a 10% chance of survival, so he planned for the worst. So he gave up my apartment. You know, he started to do things that you'd expect somebody to do if I was coming home in a box. If I'd been anywhere else on the planet, the switch would have been flicked after 30 days.
So rare was a case of Stephen's severity in Vietnam, every minute detail of his recovery was reported in national newspapers and on TV news bulletins. He's now known nationwide as Patient 91, the moniker given to him by public health officials when he fell ill in March. He came closer to dying of coronavirus than anyone else in Vietnam. The official death toll there remains at zero. Professor Long Ngoc Kieu, who serves on the Vietnamese Health Ministry's COVID-19 task force and advised on Stephen's treatment, puts his patient's survival down to more than the burden being eased on critical care units.
When the number of cases are under control, there is the time, equipment and manpower to really concentrate on treatment. But that's just part of the picture. The reason for our success is that the Vietnamese government and healthcare system had the right strategy. We imposed quarantine for those returning from abroad, and we were ready to confront and combat the COVID epidemic, even in the worst scenario.
Professor Guy Thwaites, who's the director of the Oxford University Clinical Research Unit based in Ho Chi Minh City and a government advisor on infectious diseases, says Vietnam's success in containing the virus is the product of its rapid and meticulous approach to quarantine.
They started to act very quickly, really in early January. And the first case was in January the 23rd, and it began to quarantine and isolate its individuals who had the disease and those who were in contact with the disease. And so I think that they did really, really well. And they did that at a big scale. At one point, they had tens of thousands of people quarantined, and over the course of the last 3 months, they probably quarantined close to 200,000 people.
Vietnam's forceful clampdown on COVID-19 means that every case that sprung up has led to finger-pointing and accusations that foreigners are bringing the virus into the country. Fighting the pandemic is like fighting a foreign enemy, so goes one public health slogan. Stephen, who became ill at an expat bar that was the site of Vietnam's biggest outbreak, was met with the same hostility when he tested positive.
Now, I was the first person to put my hands up and say, look, I don't feel well. There seemed to be a desire to pin it on me coming from abroad. And I said, no, that's not the case. But everybody kind of went down that route, the police, the CDC, everybody went down that route and tried to push for that.
For Stephen, the hope is his long and complicated recovery will take place back home. There's a flight arranged for him on the 12th of July.
Oliver Barnes. Health officials from around the world have been responding to the news that the United States said it was buying more than 90% of the world's supply of the COVID-19 treatment remdesivir. It's produced by the US company Gilead and has been shown to shorten stays in hospital for those most seriously ill. Here's our medical correspondent, Fergus Walsh.
When the US approved remdesivir last month, the head of the drug company Gilead did a photo opportunity in the Oval Office next to President Trump. So it's perhaps not surprising that an agreement has now been signed which reserves almost all production of the antiviral drug for the next 3 months for US patients. The success of the drug depended on the results of a clinical trial which involved patients in many countries, including the UK. Professor Martin Landrieu from Oxford University is helping to assess several treatments for coronavirus in a massive NHS study and is dismayed by the deal struck between the US and Gilead.
I think it does seem unfair. I think we need to be careful not to throw stones. There are many trials that are done in many parts of the world and where access subsequently is difficult or unaffordable. But in this particular case, I think it is unfortunate that one country will dominate the use of this drug.
While it speeds up recovery from COVID-19, remdesivir is not proven to reduce mortality. Fortunately, there's a second drug, dexamethasone, which cuts the risk of dying by a third in patients on a ventilator. What's more, it's cheap and is available worldwide. Dexamethasone costs so little because it's been off patent for decades, whereas remdesivir is a new drug, and Gilead says the price reflects the need to recoup its research and development costs.
That was Fergus Walsh. The military's been deployed in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, to control deadly protests over the killing on Monday of a prominent musician and activist, Hachalu Hundessa, in his home region of Oromia. At least 80 people are now reported to have died. Two high-profile Ethiopian opposition figures are among several arrests made. Ferdinand Omondi followed Wednesday's events.
We're getting reports that now there are armed gangs patrolling neighbourhoods, and reports coming from Oromia, a regional spokesman, confirming the deaths of dozens of people, destruction of property, and many more who are injured, and some of them in critical condition. The musician is set to be buried tomorrow in Ambo, 100 kilometres due west of Addis Ababa. But then with the arrest of Jawar Mohammed, who is a prominent Rom politician and a critic of the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, there are real concerns that this could de-escalate into ethnic tensions.
Ferdinand Omondi. A court in Algeria has given heavy prison sentences to a number of people who were close to the ousted President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. He was forced from power early last year after weeks of street demonstrations. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston told us about them.
The name that really jumps out at you is Ali Haddad. This is a man who began life running a small family hotel, but he expanded and expanded his business interests until he was running an empire involved in construction, the media, healthcare, and he became one of Algeria's richest men. He was a big backer of President Bouteflika, who was ousted last year. Ali Haddad faced corruption charges, and today he was given 18 years behind bars. Four of his brothers were also jailed, and along with the Haddad clan, two former prime ministers were jailed for 12 years each, and a number of more junior ministers were also put behind bars. Unsurprisingly, lawyers defending these men said this was more about politics than justice. One of the defense lawyers saying that these men had simply paid the price for being part of the ousted old guard.
So just how significant is this for Algeria, and what will Algerians be making of these verdicts?
Well, many people who protested against President Bouteflika in those street demonstrations that forced him from office last year went into the streets because they were angered at the degree of corruption that was associated with his rule. And they will no doubt have felt some grim satisfaction as they heard of these big sentences being handed down. But a lot of the protesters said that getting rid of President Bouteflika wasn't enough, that too many of the old guard, too many of the old elite stayed on and continue to run Algeria. The activists might say that what you saw today was a handful of the old guard being prosecuted by other members of the old guard, more a settling of scores than anything else.
Just very briefly, Alan, then, have the demonstrations continued?
Those demonstrations went on long after President Bouteflika was ousted. They went on for more than a year, and they only really came to an end when the coronavirus came to Algeria. But as it emerges from the lockdown, it's just possible you'll see a return to those pro-democracy demonstrations.
That was Alan Johnston. Real Madrid has launched its own women's football team for the first time in the club's 118-year history. It's brought out the Madrid-based team Tasson. Olivia Noon reports.
The newly styled team, officially named Real Madrid Femenino, will join the likes of Atletico Madrid and Barcelona when it plays in competitions from next season. 16 teams make up the top division of women's football in Spain, but Real Madrid have been slow to make a move into the area. It was one of the few major European football clubs without a female side. In a statement, the team said it was looking forward to the challenge and that it was committed to the development and growth of women's football.
Olivia Noon. TOI-849b is an object in space that very few people will have heard of. But astronomers are intrigued because it looks like something that hasn't been seen before. They think it's the exposed core of a planet which might once have had a thick atmosphere of gas. Dr. David Armstrong from the University of Warwick in central England is a member of the team that's been studying it.
When we got the first few data points, we thought it would turn out to be some kind of binary star. But we kept taking data and it turned out to still be a planet, just be an exceptionally massive one for its size. It's by far the most massive sort of rocky planet that we've ever discovered.
Our science correspondent Paul Rincon told us about it.
This is a planet that's 730 light years away, and it orbits a G-type star, which is a bit like our own sun, what they call a yellow star. However, it's very close into its host star, so it takes just 18 hours to complete a whole year. It's that close in, so it'd be very hot on the surface, about 1500 Celsius. It's about 3.5 times the radius of Earth, but around 40 times the mass.
OK, so it's big and it's heavy. What makes it surprising?
So the fact that it's that big, but seems to be a rocky composition, this makes it one of the biggest rocky objects we've ever seen. It has to be made from iron, rock, maybe some frozen water, but there must be very little hydrogen or helium. So at this size, usually planets have some kind of gaseous envelope, like Neptune or Saturn or Jupiter. What's odd about this is that it doesn't have any of that gas. So what the researchers have surmised is that this must be the core, what we think, you know, exists inside Jupiter and Saturn is a rocky core, big core, that's been stripped of its gas or just never accumulated it in the first place.
And just in a nutshell, Paul, why is this significant?
So what it does is, you know, we've got lots of ideas about what might be inside Jupiter and Saturn in our own solar system and you know, other gassy worlds like Neptune and Uranus. But we don't know. We've never seen them. This allows us to really observe the planet, planetary core, and see what it's made of.
That was Paul Rincon. And that is it from us for now. But there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics we've covered, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye. Actually, there is one other thing.
The Global News podcast has been nominated for an award, and we need your help and your votes if we're to win. The Listener's Choice Award recognises the best UK podcast as voted for by its fans. To cast your vote, head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. Search Global News Podcast in the search bar. Enter your name and email address to verify your details. Press submit and you'll receive an email back. Just hit confirm and that's it. You've voted. The deadline for voting is 12 noon BST on the 6th of July. Just head to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and choose the Global News Podcast.
And thank you to everyone who has voted already. You make us feel very valued.